Well, thank you, Mr. Marker, and welcome to services, everybody. It's good to be here. It's always nice to see good, clear driving weather. I mean, despite the weather, the roads were very clear coming down here or up here, so that's always a little bonus. Now, if you looked at the bulletin, saw the title of the message, you likely read it as A Modern Day Job. Or you may have read it that way. And maybe you thought I'd be referring to the jobs or roles that we play in the church and in our lives today. And in a way, this message does apply to that. But more specifically, you might read it as a modern-day Job, referring to the man in the book of the Old Testament. Was it Job or Job? And if you read it to the man's name, you'd be a little closer to the actual topic of the message, because I plan to focus on the book of Job and how it still applies to us today. The book of Job seems a little bit easy to me to get kind of bogged down in or to just gloss over, because I think we're all basically familiar with the story. We know the ending and the conclusion that Job is finally able to recognize, but often when reading the book, my mind would wander. It just seems so repetitious. Seems like there's so much repeating. His three friends talk to him. It just seems like they're all condemning him and so on. It just goes on and on. And so sometimes if I get to that part, I just want to skip over the details and head right to the conclusion. But in doing that, there's a lot in there that you'd be missing. It's a long book. It's 42 chapters. So there's a lot covered in it. You can't just condense it down to one chapter and think you understand it. So in this message, I'll try to break it down a little bit more, and I'll focus on the following topics, a little bit about the overview of the book and its importance to us today. We'll look at the roles of his friends. They were there with him. Look at the questions then that God asks Job, and the turning point that was brought about by Elihu, and then how it applies to us today. Start with a very brief outline of the book. Job was a very wealthy man. I think we know that. He was described by God as blameless and upright, one who fears God and shuns evil. But then God allows Satan to assault Job by taking away his sons and daughters and his livestock, basically all his worldly possessions. He was stricken by painful boils. His wife urged him to just curse God and die, but Job wouldn't do that. He wouldn't give up. He wouldn't call God to task for punishing him. His friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, arrived to be with him. And the Bible says there was silence for 7 days. They just sat there, didn't say anything, the four of them. And then they enter three rounds of speeches. Job speaks, and then each of the other three speak, with Job responding. We have Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job, Zophar, Job. Then it repeats Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job, Zophar, Job. And then Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job. Zophar doesn't speak on the third round of speeches, but it's a long go-around between them, a lot of discussion. Now the speeches, if you read through there, they seem to be very orderly, almost as if there had been a moderator involved. One speaks, and then Job responds, and then the next one just automatically stands up and speaks, or maybe sits down and speaks. But each speaker is given the floor without any interruption from the others, at least none that's recorded in the book. Now, the introduction in the Open Bible, which is a Bible that I was using, the New King James Version is what the scriptures will be in. But the introduction in here about this states that his friends confront him without talking behind his back. And then during their discussions with him, they tell him that he must be suffering because of his sin. That's the whole point, the only point that they can come to. It must be your fault, Job. You must have sinned. Just confess them, your sins. But Job accuses them of judging him, and he complains. He complains that God does not hear him. He complains that God is punishing him. He complains that God allows the wicked to prosper. So Job defends his innocence, and in the process, he becomes guilty of self-righteousness. Now let's consider the arguments of the three friends. Each of them takes a slightly different approach when they're talking to Job. Eliphaz, the first one to speak, he talks about Job's wickedness and his iniquity and tells him that he must return to God and that once he does that, he will remove his iniquity. He says that man on his own cannot become pure, and he also says that Job is selfish toward others. Eliphaz's arguments are presented in chapters 4 and 5, 15 and 16, and 22. Let's just look through some of the things that he says in his three speeches. Job 4, verse 7. Remember now whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright ever cut off? In Job 5:17, Eliphaz says, "Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty." Says God's correcting him. Pay attention to what God is saying. In Job 15, Eliphaz says in verse 5, Job 15, "For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, and not I. Yes, your own lips testify against you." He's saying that Job is, in effect, condemning himself by trying to justify himself. In verses 14 through 16 of Job 15, Eliphaz says, "What is man that he could be pure, and he who is born of a woman that he could be righteous? If God puts no trust in his saints and the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water?" So he's really running down not just Job, but man in general. Man cannot compare to God at all. And then in the third round of speeches, in Job 22, verses 5 through 9, Eliphaz says, "Is not your wickedness great and your iniquity without end?" He is completely condemning Job, telling him how wicked he is and that his iniquity is on himself. He says, "For you've taken pledges from your brother for no reason and stripped the naked of their clothing. You have not given the weary water to drink, and you have withheld bread from the hungry. But the mighty man possessed the land, and the honorable man dwelt in it. You sent the widows away empty, and the strength of the fatherless was crushed." And in verse 23 of Job 22, Eliphaz pretty much sums up by saying, "If you return to the Almighty, you will be built up. You will remove iniquity far from your tents." So Eliphaz, in his arguments, is placing the blame directly on Job and his disobedience, his own sins, and says it's his own fault, not God's. The second of his three friends is Bildad. Now, Bildad says that if Job were pure and upright, or if he were to become pure and upright, then God would awake for him. He tells Job that he has forgotten God, that he needs to gain understanding. Again, he's putting the blame right on Job, saying, "You've forgotten God. You need to turn to him, gain understanding from him." And his speeches are summarized in a few verses from Job 8. Job 8, if you would earnestly seek God, make your supplication to the Almighty, if you were pure and upright, surely now he would awake for you. That's verses 5 and 6 of Job 8. He's saying it's Job's fault. If you were pure and upright, like you seem to think you are, then certainly God would have heard or will hear and awake for you, as he says. And he continues in verse 13 of Job 8, so are the paths of all who forget God, and the hope of the hypocrite shall perish. Saying that everyone who fits God, who forgets God is doomed. In Job 18, his second round of arguments, in verse 2, how long till you put an end to words? Gain understanding, and afterward we will speak. Again, putting the blame on Job. It's your fault. You need to gain understanding. And after the third round, in Job 25, verse 4, how then can man be righteous before God? Or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? He's just saying that it's impossible for man on his own to be righteous before God, and telling Job that he needs to recognize this. Now, the third of his friends is Zophar, and he talks of Job's iniquity and its wickedness as something that Job needs to change. Again, putting the burden of action upon Job himself. Job 11, verse 6, and he's a little bit harsher. Job 11, 6, Zophar says, know therefore that God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves. He's saying, yes, God is punishing you, but not as much as you deserve. You deserve even worse punishment or more punishment from God. And in verse 14 of Job 11, if iniquity were in your hand and you put it far away and would not let wickedness dwell in your tents, then he goes on claiming that if Job were able to turn from his iniquity and get away from it, not let wickedness dwell in his tents, then that would help resolve his problem. And then in Job 20, the second round, Job 20, verses 4 through 5, do you not know this of old, since man was placed on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, that the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment? He again is warning Job, you may, even if you thought God were forgiving you and absolving you from everything, you'd be a hypocrite. You'd be turning God into a hypocrite. And any joy that you felt from that would be but for a moment. Now, just in going through these comments that these three friends of his said, they're not at all reassuring to Job. They provide provocation rather than understanding and reconciliation. Job just claims that they don't understand, that it's not my fault. And Job says he wants to reason directly with God. This is how Job responds in Job 13, verses 3 through 5. He wants to justify himself and wants to speak to God about it. In verse 3, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God. But you forgers of lies, you are all worthless physicians. Oh, that you would be silent, and it would be your wisdom. He thinks that he can reason with God and make God understand. And he sums up his feeling about his three friends and their opinions in Job 16, verse 2. He says, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. He just doesn't appreciate them at all and thinks they're wrong. They don't understand. Now, then the book kind of takes a turn. After these discussions with the three friends, There is an interesting turning point. And the man responsible for that turning point is another friend, Elihu, who hadn't been mentioned up till now. He appears in chapter 32, and he hasn't entered the discussion yet. And we don't know whether he'd been there all along and had heard this discussion or had just joined the group at this point. Because if you read about the book, I can't remember which source I saw this on, but it's somewhere on the internet, just looking about the discussions that Job is having. He said that there may have been other people gathered around kind of listening in the background to these arguments that were going on. We don't know. Or maybe it was just Job and his three friends on their own until Elihu came up. In Job 32, verses 1 through 3, it says that, so these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. His three friends are pretty much giving up on him. He says, Job is righteous in his own eyes. There's nothing he can do for him. Or nothing the three men can do for him. It says, then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. And he's telling that Job, you're justifying yourself. You're not listening to God. You're not justifying God. And also against his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. They told him, you're wrong, but they didn't really tell him what to do about it. Now, who was Elihu? It says he's a Buzite. We don't know much about that. That's mentioned in Genesis 22, verses 20 through 24. You don't need to turn there, but that talks about the family of Nahor in verse 20 of Genesis 22. Now, it came to pass after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, indeed, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor, Huz, his firstborn, Buz, his brother, Kemuel, the father of Aram, and so on. It goes on to name a bunch of other sons. But this is the only other mention of Buz, and it says that Elihu was a Buzite, and that's about all we know about him or about that family. But what can we tell about Elihu or about his approach to this discussion that was going on? Now, he had been listening to the others, and he was considering both sides of their discussion, but he waited until they were through speaking. He first acknowledged his youth, but also recognized that age and wisdom do not always go together. So he was respectful to the others, respectful treating them as elders or older than him, and considering their opinions. In Job 32, verses 6 through 9, he introduces himself to at least us, the audience. He says, I am young in years, and you are very old. Therefore, I was afraid, dared not declare my opinion to you. I said, age should speak, and multitude of years should teach wisdom. So he had respect for these people, both in being older than him, and also having longer to gain wisdom. But in verse 8, he says, but there is a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. Great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. So he's kind of toning down the argument. Yes, I respect you, respect your opinions, but just because you're older, you're not necessarily wiser, and you don't always understand justice. And then he waited until they were done speaking, of course, before he said any of this. Continuing in Job 32, verses 10 through 14. Therefore I say, listen to me, I also will declare my opinion. Indeed, I waited for your words. I listened to your reasonings. while you searched out what to say. I paid close attention to you, and surely not one of you convinced Job or answered his words. Lest you say, we have found wisdom. God will vanquish him, not man. Now he has not directed his words against me, so I will not answer him with your words. But he says he was angry. In verse 2, it said his wrath was aroused. This is Elihu. He feels that he has to answer. He says what needs to be said rather than what they want to hear. And in Job 32, verses 18 through 22, he says, for I am full of words. The spirit within me compels me. Indeed, my belly is like wine that has no vent. It's ready to burst like new wineskins. So this feeling was really welling up inside him. He had to speak. In verse 20 of Job 32, he says, I will speak that I may find relief. I must open my lips and answer. Let me not, I pray, show partiality to anyone, nor let me flatter any man. For I do not know how to flatter, else my maker would soon take me away. But please, Job, hear my speech and listen to all my words. That's in chapter 33, verse 1. And he continues his speaking in chapter 33, in verse 8. Surely you've spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the sounds of your words, saying, I am pure, without transgression, I am innocent, there is no iniquity in me. That's what he had heard Job saying, that he was pure, innocent, without iniquity. Yet he finds occasions against me, he counts me as his enemy, he puts my feet in the stocks, he watches all my paths. This is all Job's argument. Verse 12. Look, in this you are not righteous. This is still Elijah who is speaking now. In this you are not righteous. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend with him? For he does not give an accounting of any of his words. In other words, he doesn't need to give an accounting of his words because they're truth. In Job 33, still verse 17, he suggests that Job may have been punished to prevent a future fall. And says in verse 17, in order to turn man from his deed and conceal pride from man, he keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword. So he's saying a little punishment now is better than a harsh punishment later. In verse 5, Job 34, he again challenges a debate. He's almost daring Job to respond, to engage in a debate with him. Job 34, verses 5 and 6, for Job has said, I am righteous, but God has taken away my justice. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. He's quoting Job's argument. Job himself says he's without transgression, and he's almost inviting Job to respond back and debate with him, but Job doesn't. In Job 34, down in verse 16, he continues and says, if you have understanding, hear this. Listen to the sound of my words. Should one who hates justice govern? Will you condemn him who is most just? Is it fitting to say to a king, you are worthless, and to nobles, you are wicked? But he can't draw Job into an argument or discussion or debate on that. In verse 26 of Job 36, Job 36, 26, behold, God is great, and we do not know him, nor can the number of his years be discovered. In Job 37, this is still Elihu responding, Listen to this. This is verse 14 of Job 37. Listen to this, O Job. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know when God dispatches them and causes the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know how the clouds are balanced? Those wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge. He is still trying to draw Job into discussion, this time by telling him how great God is and that Job does not deserve to condemn God or to blame God. So Job doesn't respond, but instead God answers Job and begins a series of blunt questions. So God directly is going to question Job. Job 38, verses 1 through 3. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me." And then we get into the section of God questioning Job. Have you ever been put on the spot by a parent or a teacher or a business manager or an associate when you've made some kind of mistake or done something wrong, or you're trying to justify something that you did wrong, and you get into a kind of fruitless argument all along? You know, yeah, I did wrong, but I'm not going to admit it. I think we've probably done that. You may be asked a series of questions which are unanswerable. And I think of my mom, for example. If I did something wrong, well, everybody else is doing it. Well, she'd say, well, if everybody else jumped off a bridge, would you do that? I think that's a standard response. Another one I remember saying was, well, you didn't tell me not to do it. And that's probably even a worse one. But of course, she responded properly to that and put me in my place. But that was just my mom. Or there have been occasions at work where I had to kind of justify a mistake, but I knew it was wrong, and so it was better to just say what happened. Now we come into this question, or this chapter of God's questions. I remember this just from previous readings of the book of Job, and in my head I had thought, well, maybe I thought there were probably about 20 questions that God answered, all kind of summed up in one chapter. And I was surprised to find that it was quite a few more than that. When I reread the book and I got to chapter 38, I saw that there were many more questions, and they continue over the next few chapters. So out of curiosity, now I didn't remember these questions going on and or there being so many of these questions, unanswerable questions from God. I tried to count the question marks just to estimate the number of questions. And in chapters 34 through 41, I counted about 74 questions rather than the 20 or 30 that I had thought in my head that he asked. But the actual count, according to an internet search, is that there are 77 questions asked by God. And every one of them is unanswerable by Job or by any other human. God asked questions about the creation of the earth, about the stars, the sea, the clouds, how each is limited in its movement. He asks about light and the stars and snow and hail and winds and rain. God brought those. We have no way to answer how they happen. He asks about clouds and lightning. And he asks about various types of animals and birds, how they get their food. Ask questions about the ostrich and the stork and hawks and eagles and horses. He just goes on. There's no end to God's questions. Well, there is an end. That's apparently 77, but every one of them is something that we can't answer. In Job 40, verses 1 and 2, Job 40, "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, 'Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it.'" So if Job tried to answer any of these questions, he, in effect, would be rebuking God. And Job finally recognizes himself and what his problem is. He says in verse 4, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." So Job finally gets the point. He realizes that the blame is on him. Then we come to the condemnation. Job's three friends are condemned by God. In verse 7, still in Job 40, or excuse me, Job 42. "And so it was, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'My wrath is aroused against you and your two friends.'" These three friends that had been arguing with Job, or that Job had been arguing with, said, "My wrath is aroused against all three of them, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." And notice that he condemns the three friends, doesn't say anything about Elihu. Elihu isn't mentioned again. Well, then Job prospers again after that. We know that his wealth is restored, and it becomes pretty much like it had been in the beginning. What else about Elihu can we say? He's not mentioned again after this chapter. Elihu limits his comments to things that Job has directly said in his hearing, and he goes right at the problem. Job seems to treat God as some sort of equal whom he can debate with. Elihu says that God responds in various ways, not always understood by man. I titled this message, "Modern Day Job." And in a way, each of us is a modern-day equivalent of Job, in that we go through experiences that we don't understand, or things that are fair, or don't think are fair or deserved. And yet, it might apply to our present-day job as well, because we all have a job in life. To recognize our own shortcomings and to strive to overcome, none of us can answer any of God's 77 questions to Job. None of us can fully recognize God's greatness. I'd like to quote from Darris McNeely, and this is on the UCG.org Beyond Today website. You can search for it if you're interested. But Mr. McNeely says, "Four friends and 42 chapters to get to this moment of understanding. A lot of people read this book of the Old Testament and wonder what it is all about. I usually answer with this question: how many friends and how many chapters of experience must we go through to get to the same conclusion?" And it's a good thing to ponder. Well, Job was very fortunate to have a friend such as Elihu who could convince him to understand God's purpose and to help him understand his own shortcomings. We could each benefit from having such a friend in our own lives, but even more importantly, we should recognize that it is part of our modern-day job to strive to be such a friend in others' lives.